are listening to the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation. Learn more at starlegacyfoundation.org. If you enjoy this podcast, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. Our guest for this episode is Dr. Noreen Russell, an OB from Ireland, who is the lead clinician for early pregnancy care at the clinic where she works. She is also a member of the pregnancy loss clinical and research teams, as well as the perinatal medicine team. Her research has resulted in more than 20 peer-reviewed original papers and more than 80 published conference proceedings. Dr. Russell's research interests include high-risk obstetric care, prenatal diagnosis and screening, recurrent miscarriage, and obstetric ultrasound, including the effect of maternal diabetes on fetal cardiology. Well, Dr. Russell, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
You're very welcome, Chris.
My first question for you is, I like to ask OBs this question who get involved with stillbirth and pregnancy loss, because most OBs get into their field because they like the joyful part of pregnancy, the happy, the hopeful. But you have kind of become interested in pregnancy loss and stillbirth, and I'm just wondering, how did you get drawn to that part of OB?
One of the worst telephone calls you can get is a phone call from the emergency department from an experienced midwife who says, you've got to come down here. This lady's come in usually with reduced fetal movement and I can't detect a fetal heartbeat. That's the worst call to get, because no matter what you're doing, your heart starts to race and you immediately think, okay, I've got to get down there. How soon can I get there? And unfortunately, usually when you do reach the emergency department and you start to scan the patient, the midwife is very often correct and you can't detect a fetal heartbeat, and you have to break this news to the parents. Sometimes mom on her own, she's just popped in because she wasn't really that worried and she just wants you to tell her everything's okay. And that had a huge impact on me, those moments, and having to, I suppose, watch this, you know, this the hope completely and utterly disappear out of her face or of their faces and say, look, I'm really sorry, but I can't see a heartbeat and I should be able to see a heartbeat and I've looked really closely and unfortunately that means that your baby has died. They are the absolute worst words I have to utter. And I think from very early on, I just wanted to ideally not have to utter them at all, but in at least, you know, try and understand why and try and reduce that awful, 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 awful experience for parents, and just try and make stillbirth less of a common occurrence. When I was training, that spurred me on to research this area. And then when I was in training, I had the good fortune to work with a senior colleague, Keelan O'Donoghue, who was already doing research in this area and was very methodical and very just believed in very, very thorough investigations, doing everything the same way, the same time, trying to do the same blood test, trying to really, really increase our understanding of why stillbirth occurs. So it was a very natural fit then when I became a consultant myself that I would continue on researching in this area.
So the majority of the people who listen to this podcast are families who have experienced pregnancy loss, and so they're always talking about being on the receiving end of the news that you just talked about, how it's so hard to deliver that news. I'm sorry, there's no heartbeat. But I'm curious to get your perspective on what it's like to deliver that news. Do you receive training for those types of moments, or is it just you have to follow your instincts and do what you think is best in those situations?
It's interesting, Chris. I would have to say I received very little, probably no training in delivering that news. And for me, it's It's always I'm always trying to sense, okay, where are these parents at? It's just trying to get into that headspace and say, right, okay, what do they need from me? Sometimes parents are really already worried. Sometimes the mom is really worried and you're just confirming what she has already worked out. Sometimes it comes as a complete bolt from the blue. And I'm in the position where I'm teaching people about delivering this news. What I try and do and what I try and teach is I try and teach connection and just speaking slowly, just looking the patient in the eye and saying, I'm sorry, and really, really meaning it. I think it's important not to say too much, because once you say those words, I'm sorry, but your baby's heart's not beating, your baby is, you know, sometimes that's not enough. Sometimes you have to say your baby has died. You have to be very blunt because the news is so awful. This isn't the time for nicisms and trying. There's no easy way to deliver this news. And then stop and just let that news sink in and not fill the silence, not keep on talking, but just actually let it sink in. And that's it's awful. I can recall numerous occasions where I've had to do this. And each of those has affected me very, very deeply.
So shifting gears a little bit, when you work with pregnant women, you are an advocate for parenting to begin during pregnancy. How did you develop this approach? And can you explain what it means and how it might differ from other approaches to pregnancy?
Yeah, I suppose the way it developed is that so often the presenting complaint or women's first intuition that something is wrong is that perception of decreased fetal movement. And there are so many conflicting websites, guidelines out there for mums. There are movement apps. There's a lot of advice about movement, but I just try and keep it really, really simple. So what I say to my mums, I say, I usually have this conversation around kind of 20 weeks, 22 weeks, even before they're feeling movement, and say, what I want you to become familiar with is what your baby's normal. So very similar to the advice you get when you have a newborn, but starting that advice earlier and saying, I want you to become familiar with what your baby's normal, so that when I ask you about movement, you can say, my baby always moves before, you know, in the morning or in the evening or after I eat or when I sit down. And I don't give them specific guidance, you know, that your baby should move 10 times a day or 10 times in an hour, because every baby is an individual and every baby is a little bit different. But what I really want my moms to do is say, okay, what's normal for my baby? And then recognize when their baby is not behaving normally in utero. So it's that concept of, you're not kind of comparing your baby to the baby you read about in a book or what you see on the app or what your friend tells you their baby does. You're saying, okay, what's normal for my baby? I think that's a really, really important concept. And then you can gauge and you can say, yeah, my baby is definitely not doing its normal thing today because it always moves when I sit down or when I lie down. And I think it's engaging that maternal intuition. Do I think everything's okay or do I not? And I've talked to my mums about intuition and I say, look, you know, if you're worried and you think your baby is quiet and not moving as well, don't talk yourself out of that worry. Don't say, oh, I'm probably imagining it, but try and understand why do I think that? What's making me feel that? Try and tell my mums just to tap into that intuition, because I think that's a really critical part of the message to reduce stillbirth. It's enabling our moms to believe that they have, you know, to speak up for the things they're worried about. I find it absolutely devastating when I'm doing post-stillbirth counselling or when I'm doing my follow-up visits and mom says to me, you know, I knew for a couple of days beforehand that things weren't right, but I went to my you know, I talked to my friends and they said, oh, they can, you know, babies can get quiet. And one of the greatest myths I think we have to tackle is this myth that babies should slow down at coming up to term. So I actively tackle that by saying, you know, by saying to my patients, you know, your baby should not slow down coming up to term. Yes, the characteristic of the movement changes. It's more like a roll or a shuffle. It's not a swing and kick anymore, but it certainly shouldn't get quieter. And that's something you need to worry about.
So the approach you're describing about parenting beginning during pregnancy, it sounds like common sense, and it should be utilized worldwide and all over the place. But why do you think that is a unique approach? Why do you think this approach is not utilized more often?
I think in some ways, mums have been are kind of pushed to the side, I guess, and technology has kind of taken over. And I worry a lot about the devices that are available now for moms, and they can listen to the, you know, a fetal Doppler, they can listen to the heartbeat. And I've seen moms who've been reassured by that. So they've thought, okay, my baby's a bit quiet. They put on the heart rate monitor and they can detect the baby's heartbeat. Of course, that just means, yes, the heart's still beating. It doesn't mean that everything is okay. And I think advancing technology has not necessarily been for the betterment of mums. And I think that whole, the concept that, I mean, yeah, I agree with you. It's a really simple concept that if you feel everything isn't okay, you should listen to that, because you should listen to that inner voice, because that's what happens when your baby's outside the womb and you look at your newborn baby. You're forever looking at them, looking at cues, watching how they move, watching how they sleep, and trying to work out, are they tired? Are they hungry? Are they well? Are they unwell? So it makes complete sense to me that it's, you know, that you should be doing the same thing with the in utero baby, with your baby who's prior to birth. I think that's increasingly being, I'm not the only one who's thinking like this, but it is increasingly being spoken about. But I think we need a population awareness and a population education that, you know, you have to, this isn't an option. You can't, you know, intermittently think about movements. You have to really be aware of your baby's movements during pregnancy, because you may be the first person who has a sense that something is wrong. And by virtue of presenting to the hospital, you may prevent a stillbirth. And I think that's the critical message.
So shifting gears to your research, and I know you've been involved with a study on stillbirth risk factor knowledge, just general awareness, yep, among staff, and I believe this means hospital staff. And
yep,
you have also had a couple of colleagues who have done some research on stillbirth awareness among the general population. I'd like to kind of go into both of those bits of research because they're both interesting to me. Let's start with the staff, the hospital staff. What were the findings? What did you learn from that study?
Yeah, it was really interesting. So we had 212 hospital staff, so the majority midwives, some working in antenatal care, some working on labor ward, some working on the gynae ward. And we found that whereas smoking, pregnancy, in, you know, pre-existing hypertension were well recognized as risk factors. So I'm going to take the two of those because they're just very well recognized. But they were well recognized, and over 90% of the respondents identified them as a risk factor for stillbirth. But there was still a significant proportion who answered either no. So 4% answered no, that's not a risk factor, and 4% said they didn't know. I found that quite fascinating, because they're, I suppose, you know, two risk factors that are very kind of well recognized. And then when it came down to previous stillbirth, which again, I suppose, because of my research, because of my interest, I thought that everybody knew if you've had a previous stillbirth, you know, your risk is increased. You need to watch these moms very carefully. We have a special clinic for moms who've had a previous stillbirth, and I take care of a lot of moms in that clinic. But actually, when we asked the general hospital staff who might just be working in normal antenatal care or on the labor ward, only 85% of them identified that previous stillbirth was a risk for a future stillbirth. So I guess it was really interesting for us, and it showed us there's a lot of work we still need to do. Obesity was another one I was kind of fascinated with, because this is a growing epidemic in Ireland as in other places, and it does significantly increase the risk of stillbirth. And that was 20% of our population said they didn't know whether a BMI over 30 made any difference to stillbirth risk. So although, yes, over 80% identified it as a risk factor, there was still that high proportion of those who said, I don't know. And I think it has really given us, I suppose, food for thought about where we guide our education programs in the hospital. Because it's not enough that you've got a team who are really interested in high-risk pregnancy and are really interested in pregnancy loss and that they know all the risk factors. You need everybody. You need your most junior midwife, your most junior doctor. You need everybody to know what the risk factors are. So when they're providing antenatal care, that they are able to, first of all, identify the risk factors, and secondly, share those risk factors with mums. Because it's critical. I mean, if I have a mum who's older, we know that age over 35 is a significant risk factor for stillbirth. If I have a mum who's older, who's obese, and who has hypertension, I'm telling her, I'm saying, look, you've got three risk factors for stillbirth. If anything new changes, so if you start to feel your baby is quiet, I want you to come straight into hospital. If you feel a bit off, if you get a bit headachy, I'm thinking preeclampsia, I want you to come to hospital. And I think healthcare workers knowing about the risk factors is important, and that enables them to streamline care and stratify it and provide the more high-risk patient with more regular visits. But the critical next step is actually having the courage to have that conversation with mums and say, listen, you know, I don't want to, you know, obviously in a way that you don't worry your mums, but say, look, I need to share this information with you. You have these risk factors which make me worried about your risk of stillbirth. So we need to keep a close eye on you. We need to make sure your baby is growing well. We need to make sure you know, what you can do to keep an eye on your baby is watch your baby's movements. And that's all starting the conversation, because at the moment, I think we're not talking to our mums enough about stillbirth.
So let's talk now about the study that your colleagues conducted about the level of awareness the general public has about stillbirth. What were the findings of that study?
Yeah, that was really interesting again. So it was nearly 1,000, it was 999 Irish adults, cross-sectional study, just telephoned by Ipsos, and more than half believed that stillbirth happened because of a problem with the baby. That was, so 40% believed that it was a problem with the mother, and only 2 out of the 999 people surveyed mentioned reduced fetal movement as a risk factor. So that was, I think, a fascinating piece of research. Interestingly, again, those who didn't identify risk factors, 28% thought that alcohol was a risk factor for stillbirth. 22% identified smoking, which I would have thought, I would have actually expected it to be a lot higher. I mean, I guess that's just because this is something I'm so aware of, that smoking is such a significant risk factor. I was surprised only 22% identified it in the general population. And then I think the actual, I suppose, occurrence of it, the incidence of stillbirth, only 17% of people correctly identified the rate of stillbirth, and most thought that it was less common. So in Ireland, the rate is around 1 in 238 births, but most people thought it was less common. So interestingly, nearly 3 out of 5 people said they were unable to identify any stillbirth risk factors at all. So I know this is a study. There were, you know, all age groups are represented, both genders, but for 3 in 5 to say that, you know, they couldn't think of any stillbirth risk factor, that's a fascinating finding. And I think that to me speaks of fatalism, that it's, you know, oh well, it's either, you know, I haven't a clue why it happens, and sure, maybe there's no reason, or else it's drinking and smoking and drug abuse, as opposed to understand that there are actually other medical factors, like as I mentioned previously, like obesity, like advanced maternal age, like hypertension, that understanding that there are other factors is not there at all in the general population. So we've a lot of work to do. That's what this study showed me. It's like, well, we have a lot of population education to work on.
So I'm going to make a speculative statement, and you let me know if there's any truth to this in your opinion.
Okay.
Is it possible that one of the reasons why awareness of stillbirth is so low, because doctors are concerned about not stressing out mothers or pregnant women about the worst case scenario when they're pregnant?
Yeah, I think that's a huge contributory factor. And actually, in Daniel Newsom's work, that patient paper I was just talking about, 88% of people surveyed said that stillbirth should be included in antenatal education. So I think there's a real mismatch there.
Yeah.
So the vast majority of people said, of course, that should be included in antenatal education. And yet, us on the medical side, we're like, oh, we can't, you know, we're worried about stressing women out. And that's something that I'm working on again in my own practice. It's actually just saying the word. And just saying, look, you know, I'm worried about you because you know, this is your second time coming in with reduced fetal movement. I'm worried because your blood pressure is a little bit high. The reason I'm worried, or the reason I want to bring you into hospital, is because I'm worried about stillbirth. And I have said that to quite a few mums, and none of them have reacted in a shocked manner. They're thinking that, and it's really proving to me that, you know, that's in my patient's mind. They've already thought that. They probably, you know of somebody. Stillbirth is common. They probably know of somebody who had a stillbirth, or as you move into pregnancy, whereas you mightn't be so aware of stillbirth as a reality before pregnancy, you know, during pregnancy, you nearly always hear of somebody or a friend of a friend who has a stillbirth, or you come across it in blogs and Facebook pages. You come across that concept that, wow, sometimes a baby can be stillborn. And it's, you know, it's a complete natural thought jump that moms go, I wonder, could that happen to me? And when I've had that conversation with mothers and said, look, you know, this is why I'm going to talk to you about induction as we get close to term, because we know that. So that's where it comes up a lot, actually. So I have, my moms who are 40 or above, typically I would offer induction of labor around 40 weeks. So we know that their risk of placental failure starts earlier than moms who are under 40. So rather than waiting for 10 days over the due date, I would usually offer them induction around term. And sometimes they're not really that keen on it. And I say, look, I understand. And, you know, we'll have to just gauge it as we get there. But the reason I'm having this conversation with you is because we know the stillbirth rate increases in mums who are over 40 after 40 weeks. And again, I have found the reaction from patients to be very positive. They're kind of glad to put it on the table. And they often have another couple of questions then to ask in that vein about stillbirth, their risks, what they need to be worried about, what they can do. And so I think it's something that, you know, I think we in the medical profession have to trust our mums, and not be overly paternalistic and not protect them. They know stillbirth is a risk, and they want us to talk about it. I always think it's a really bizarre thing. When I had my first baby, on the first morning, I got around 5 different leaflets about cot death, about SIDS, about sudden infant death, I started completely freaking out about cot death, and I was so worried about him. And what about if he's going to have a cot death? Stillbirth is 10 times more common than cot death. And yet we do not spend a fraction of the time discussing it that we do discussing cot death.
And just for clarification, is cot death the same thing as SIDS?
Yes, sorry. Yeah, cot death is what the term we use in Ireland. But yes, SIDS, sudden infant death. So sudden unexplained infant death.
Just wanted to make sure we knocked down the cultural barrier there.
I know, sorry about that. Yeah, no. SIDS is the exact same thing as cot death. My apologies.
Got it. So the International Stillbirth Alliance was recently held. Its annual conference was recently held in Cork, and I know that you were very involved in the planning. And just curious what you noticed about the level of interest about stillbirth from around the globe. Are we seeing any momentum? Are we seeing an uptick in overall interest, or is it plateaued? What are you noticing?
That's a really good question. I guess because I am personally so interested, that's a difficult question for me to answer, because in my research group in Cork, so in our hospital, in my research group, which meets once a week, we talk about stillbirth regularly, and in my clinic, I'm every single week I meet a mom, at least one, or probably usually more, who've had a previous stillbirth. So I see it. I see it everywhere, and I worry about it a lot. Now that the having the ISA in Cork was interesting, we were absolutely delighted with the turnout. There was over 400 delegates. It was fantastic. But everyone who was there was really, really interested in the topic of stillbirth. So it's really difficult to gauge how's that represented in different countries? Because when you just meet the people who are interested in this topic, you don't necessarily get a good feel for those who are not interested. Do you know what I mean? It's a difficult one. I mean, there was a large delegation from the US. There were lots of people from Australia and New Zealand. Probably less from mainland Europe than I would have expected. There was a good turnout from Irish midwives and obstetricians, but it's a difficult one to gauge, because it's not enough just to have, like, it's not enough for your as a community of obstetricians and midwives. One of my absolute pet hates is when I hear stillbirth being talked about. It, oh, that's a niche area. It is not a niche area. It is something that can affect any mom. And, you know, you might think she's, you know, you're looking after her and you think, oh, she's, you know, low risk. And, you know, she's, that's another term I hate, low risk, because there's no such thing as low risk. It's normal risk. But you've got, you know, if you're providing antenatal care, no matter whether you think your patients are high risk or low risk, stillbirth can happen. So you can't say, oh, well, that's, you know, stillbirth and stillbirth research is a niche area. Every single healthcare provider has to be in tune with what the risk factors are and sharing those with moms, because if we're going to bring down the rate of stillbirth, we all need to be on the same page. Sorry, that's a very long answer. Did I actually answer what you asked me?
You did. And it was a long answer, but it was a passionate answer. So that is just fine. My final question for you is, I know you've been working with families who utilize perinatal palliative care services. Can you describe the program, what value you see it provides for families, and how has this program been accepted by families and health professionals?
Okay, so perinatal palliative care has always been a part of antenatal care in Ireland because termination of pregnancy is not easily available. And it's not legal in Ireland, so therefore Irish women have to travel either to the UK or Europe when they are going to have a termination in the case of a fetal abnormality. What that led to perinatal palliative care always being around and being an option. But it wasn't, 20, 30 years ago, it wasn't as necessarily as organised. And didn't probably, I suppose we didn't identify it as perinatal palliative care. It was just what you did. Whereas I think in recent years, we have become a lot more focused on what an active. So when you realize your baby has a fetal abnormality, obviously you can choose to terminate the pregnancy or you can choose to continue. But rather than continuing the pregnancy being a passive event, I see it now as much more of an active continuing of the pregnancy, and providing care for those parents and their other family members, often their children, their parents, extended family. So it's a decision to continue the pregnancy, knowing that the baby's not going to survive, maybe stillborn, may die early, maybe stillborn, may die soon after birth, and certainly won't have a long, is unlikely to have a long duration of life outside of the womb. But it's accepting that during the pregnancy and preparing for that demise or that death in a very active way. So rather than just letting it happen, but talking to parents about creating memories, going and taking photographs in important places, that so take pictures of mom when she's pregnant, at the family beach or in the home somewhere that's really important, and that making memories during the course of the pregnancy and starting to talk during the pregnancy about that baby's death, what's going to happen after delivery, the process of delivery, meeting the neonatal team and having a discussion about, yes, we know the baby's not going to survive long term outside the womb, so there's no, that making sure the baby's not going to be whisked away to the neonatal unit to get IV lines and to get ventilated, but that whatever time that baby has is going to be in mom and dad's arms in a quiet space, and that is, so the baby's going to be kept warm, of course, be comfortable, be kept comfortable, be that get with pain relief, and just keeping that atmosphere, that calmness and that acceptance. Yes, this baby is going to die. It's been all, signaled beforehand, and making sure that death is as peaceful as it possibly can be in that environment. We have a special labor ward room, which is slightly separate to the rest of the birthing rooms, and that's usually where our moms who are having perinatal palliative care give birth to their baby. And I suppose just making sure that the other family members can come in when they go back up to the ward, that, and if there's other children, that they get to come in and spend time with their brother or sister, that sometimes the grandparents do. And we have an amazing volunteer photographers from Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep who will come in and take beautiful shots of family shots, photographs of baby with the family. And these are just, I suppose, that it's very much more of an active process rather than a passive, I don't want to make the decision to have a termination, so I'm going to do nothing. It's not doing nothing. It's actually using that time to adapt to this new pregnancy that wasn't the one you expected you were going to have, but that is, it's using that time during the pregnancy to grieve for the baby. I think when parents have a termination, they need a lot of support and time afterwards, because the whole process, no matter whether you continue or whether you terminate, parents need bereavement support, they need care, the needs are very, very similar, but it's just a matter of timing. It's about where those needs come in. And I think that's where in perinatal palliative care, a lot of that work is done before the birth actually happens.
Well, Dr. Russell, it has been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks very much, Chris.
That's all for this episode of the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation. I'm Chris Duffy. Thanks for listening.